Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, and it is an enormous honor this morning to be joined by Tyler Cowen, who truly needs no introduction, but I will simply say that Marginal Revolution and Conversations with Tyler, I think, are essential reading for anyone who wants to understand the world. So thank you very much for being here.
Happy to be here, Ben. Thank you for having me on.
And my tribute to Conversations with Tyler is to say that this will be the conversation that I hope our listeners will have wished me to have had with Tyler. So I will start by saying that, like many humanists, I've learned a great deal about economics and social science from Marginal Revolution, but I've also learned a lot about the arts and humanities from reading over the years. I don't think there are that many people who are truly conversant in both quantitative and qualitative fields. So my first question would be, from your perspective, do you think that there's something that those who are quantitative thinkers who are not aesthetically trained, is there something that they miss out on, or do you find anything lacking in terms of the aesthetic vision or sensibility of quantitative thinkers?
Well, how people think about government, politics, culture war issues often depends greatly on their sense of aesthetics. Maybe they think it's ethics or morals, and sometimes it is, but just a vision of how society ought to look, what would please them, what they would find appropriate, has a great deal to do with aesthetics. And if one more formally studies aesthetics as a thing in the arts, I think one is much better equipped to understand that angle of politics, which I view as really essential to 2026 and maybe most other times as well. So that's one way in which it matters. But also, just if you're trying to understand human behavior, there's the neoclassical rational model, there's behavioral economics. They're both very useful. But I feel knowing aesthetics gives you this extra dimension above and beyond either of those two.
Yeah. That reminds me of, I often think, you know, the so-called ideological Turing test and the ability to model what is in the mind of another, particularly a political opponent who may appear crazy or stupid or irrational. And I often think if people had just read a lot more novels, they might have, you know, great novels would give you a sense of why people sometimes do the things they do. But
in great novels, they're really hard to understand, right? Or a lot of paintings, symphonies, wherever you want to look. And if you just put a lot of time into trying to figure them out, I think it's maybe the single best way to become smarter, because they're so hard and you're never really done with them. And you then become much better at appreciating the virtues of other people. Yeah. So you like them more. And because they see that you actually get their virtues, they like you more. It's like a total win-win from my point of view.
Yeah. I mean, I remember a few months ago, I saw a long, thoughtful Twitter post from Patrick Collison about Middlemarch. And I thought, wow, I don't know how many tech people are reading Middlemarch, but I hope that they are. And
because of Patrick. Yeah.
Good. Okay.
I think that tweet, I mean, a while ago, but it had several million imprints, which is amazing, right?
Yeah.
So he's like the most popular literary critic of the year.
Yeah.
No matter what one may think of that, but that needs to be taken very seriously.
Yeah. And I saw at one point, I think that Matt Iglesias had been in a Catherine Project reading group for Middlemarch or something.
And so I thought, Matt reads a lot of novels, and he got on a George Eliot kick and read all the second tier Eliot novels, which he learned a lot from. You know, there's an argument to be made for not just reading the great books, whatever that's supposed to mean, but just reading more deeply in any particular area.
Yeah. Well, so follow-up question is, if you were designing either a formal curriculum for university or informal advice for people educating themselves, picture, let's say, a person who's highly skilled in say, tech or finance, but has not had much formal training in aesthetics, what kind of advice would you give?
I'm not sure formal training is what they need. I think a love of it and pursuit of it is more valuable.
Yeah.
I mean, one piece of advice would just be like, email you, right?
Yeah.
Ask GPT, tell it a bit about yourself, see what it thinks you should do. But just to start on things you think you might love and pursue them, I think is better than any more formal piece of advice. Just try stuff. And don't put it down.
Yeah. In fact, just last night I was having a conversation with some very well-educated people without any particular background in the arts, and it came up, as actually it often does, this sense, you know, it's almost like the beginning of a Platonic style dialogue, the sort of common sense that taste is purely subjective, that I like this, you like that, and that's it, implying that it's not really possible to rationally argue about aesthetic judgments because You know, I like vanilla, do you like strawberry? That's fine. I wonder if people say that to you, and if so, how you respond.
They do say that. I think that reflects a shortcoming of arguing, not a shortcoming of aesthetics. Okay. So just a simple example. I pretty firmly believe that Beethoven's Fifth Symphony is better and more important than his Second Symphony.
Yeah.
And I think it would actually be hard to find many people who'd heard all the symphonies who would not agree with that. But I recognize full well in a debate, I couldn't demonstrate it. I couldn't derive it from uncontroversial premises. But I think as claims go, it's probably more objective than a lot of things we like to say. And I don't feel bad about believing it strongly.
Yeah.
And I quite like the Second Symphony, to be clear.
Yeah. Well, so moving to kind of ideas or theories about aesthetics, I may have missed, I don't know if you've commented publicly, but Ian McGilchrist, who's sort of a polymath with a medical neuroscientific background, has published some very long books with a theory that can be characterized as saying that the kind of intuitive, holistic way of understanding the world, which you might find in, say, poetry or painting, in the modern world, he thinks, is somewhat at a disadvantage compared to the more analytical, task-oriented, utility-oriented way of thinking that wants to sort of take things apart and see how they work. And he thinks that this is a problem because there are ways of understanding reality, again, say poetry, painting, intuitive, holistic, et cetera, that are underrated or undervalued in kind of our modern society. I wonder if you have any thoughts or comments on his theory.
I'm never happy with claims like that. You didn't mention it, but first, I don't accept the whole left brain, right brain distinction. I don't think that really is held up in modern neuroscience. Second, you know, intuitive, holistic. You read a short Emily Dickinson poem. Is that holistic? I don't know. I'm not sure I'm qualified to classify it, but that's not the first word that comes to mind.
Right.
You listen to atonal music. Is that holistic? Or it seems to be imposing a lot of artificial categories on things that can stand for themselves. And then finally, there's this recent dialogue with Peter Thiel. It's on YouTube. And they say, Peter, you know, the AIs are coming. Are they going to come first for the math people or the literature people? And Peter says, oh, they're going to come first for the math people. Those skills won't be valuable anymore. Now, Peter may or may not be right, but it's certainly quite possible that he's right. And then finally, most people don't think well in terms of math at all. How many people are really even minimally literate in statistics? I think actually a lot more people appreciate the arts. So it's like four or five different reasons I have for objecting to that point.
Okay.
And they're all fairly independent. So I don't buy it. I just think it's all much more complicated than that.
Sure. Well, no, that's worth thinking about. So this is a slightly related question, and it's a quote from Michael Hanby, who says, quote, questions in the what is form can no longer be intelligibly posed within the dominant form of reason, which can only ask functional questions. How many, how far, by what influence, and to what effect? Ideas cease to disclose reality and are set in opposition to it as instruments for its manipulation. My comment on this quote is that when I, if I'm skimming the abstract or a paper in the social sciences, my first reaction is often that the sort of what is questions are somewhat taken for granted. For instance, the set of concepts or the sort of intuition about reality seems to reflect sort of the conventional wisdom that has just been absorbed without really thinking about it. And the analysis may be very sophisticated, but I often wish that they'd tried to delve a little bit more deeply into the question of what is before trying to kind of take it apart and reason about it. So I don't know. I wonder what you think of that quote from Hanby or my comment following.
I agree with your comment, which I like. I'm not sure I understand the quotation.
I have
a saying, proper nouns are underrated. And I recall there not being a single proper noun in that quotation. So I'm not sure what he means. But again, I liked your words.
Okay.
And I would make the general point, there's just so many top-tier social scientists. They do great work. It's very sophisticated. But their basic worldview, they'll take from some mix of like NPR and New York Times, and I don't mean the arts page of the Times either.
Yeah.
And television. Oh, they'll watch the smarter shows. It just, to me, seems so utterly disappointing somehow.
Yeah.
And maybe we're just saying the same thing there.
Yeah. I'm not I'm not sure I can formulate this clearly, but that makes me think. I mean, you know, I certainly spend a lot of time online myself, but I'm also old enough to remember that when I was sort of college age and doing traveling or even just kind of exploring nearby, my pre-existing knowledge about whatever I was about to experience would really be a couple of paragraphs in a travel guide saying, you should go here, it's nice and interesting. And thus, when I stepped off the train or whatever I experienced would be not totally new, but almost totally new. And it makes me, you know, I'm a little sad that to think that any sort of such experience now, unless you kind of work really hard at it, almost everything that you see if you travel somewhere will sort of, you'll sort of have a vast array of pre-existing knowledge that maybe makes it a little less novel. I don't know what you think of that perspective, because I know you might disagree with that, but I'm curious what you think.
I think it depends on the part of the world. So I think traveling, say, to Western Europe, maybe the quality of that peaked in the 1980s.
Yeah.
But much of the rest of the world, especially Latin America, to me still feels quite fresh and fairly under-discovered. And guidebooks can clue you in a bit. But I think that the time to travel there or, say, India, that's peaking now, or maybe it hasn't peaked yet. So I think it's a European problem. It's extreme in Venice, Florence, you know, the usual places. But you can get around it. I don't think it takes really that much work. Just reorient where you're going to go. You know, you go to Java, Indonesia, a very fresh experience, I think, full of surprises.
And I'll put a link in there. There was a wonderful recent in the Free Press advice about Mexico that Tyler recently published there, which I hope will enlighten and inspire a number of readers to be curious about Mexico.
And more places are getting ruined. I'm sure you're worried about this. Like Tokyo peaked sometime in the past for a traveler.
Yeah.
But there's just so much of the world that is still fresh. So I don't feel too bad about it.
Yeah. I was talking to a couple of Japanese guys from a Japanese art gallery who were here for an art fair a couple of months ago. And I expressed admiration for their work. And I said, you know, someday I'd love to go. I've never been to Japan. And he kind of sighed and said, oh, there's a lot of tourists right now. And I felt like I should apologize. Oh, I'm sorry about that. But still, despite that, I'm going to get there someday.
I don't think it's that far from peak. And the tourists tend to cluster, as in Mexico City. So it's still a wonderful time to visit Japan and Tokyo. And outside of Tokyo, but it's not unspoiled in the way it almost was not too long ago. But it's one of the best travel experiences you can have, I think, Japan still.
Yeah.
But past peak also, but not by that much.
Okay.
Like to him, he's so used to the peak.
Right.
To him, it feels terrible, but it's not terrible.
Yeah. Well, I wanted also to ask the question. Let's say the question of nature and culture. There is a sort of conventional wisdom thinking about culture of, let's say, pure, complete cultural relativism or pure social constructionism, that, you know, kind of blank slateism, if you will. And you could say that people take, you know, particularly academics, I think, often take the starting point of something like that. On the other hand, I put in my email, there are these attempts to ground culture and implicitly aesthetic judgments in some form of human nature, and examples being music. The octave is a phenomenon in physics. There's physiology that there's some sort of connection with nature and music. As colleague Fred Turner published something with a neuroscientist a while ago called The Neural Liar, which argued that most poetic lines in different cultures are a certain length of about 3 seconds, which they claim corresponds to the sense of the present or the now. And the third example, in the field of architecture and design, the late Christopher Alexander published another, like McGilchrist, another very long series of books claiming that there were 15 fundamental properties of order, which, based on his somewhat informal empirical studies with Berkeley students and other people, were present in what he called good design. So there's a spectrum between pure social constructionism and, let's say, the strongest possible theories of nature and natural, et cetera. I wonder what your views are on that.
Well, that helps in part to explain why consensus is possible amongst critics.
Yeah.
One of my more strongly held views is that in the arts, most things that are claimed to be great are in fact great. It's a very simple hypothesis. But if you just picked up like Penguin Guide to Classical Music, something very normy.
Yeah.
you know, even from 20 years ago, and like, who are the great composers? Or ask GPT, like the list you get, they're all great composers. Yeah. Or who are the great painters, sculptors? It's a pretty kind of efficient market in that way. I think more recent creators, there can be people elevated who won't last, or these trends. Certain things are politicized, as they were back then in earlier times.
Yeah.
But like Rodin, Michelangelo, they're just astonishingly good. And I don't feel that's arbitrary, and I don't think history feels it's arbitrary.
Yeah. Slightly related, you know, talking to a lot of different people over the years, there are, you know, I've noticed there are people who may be passionate about one form of art and not so much another. I'm thinking of one person I talked to who is truly profoundly devoted to music, but doesn't really care much about poetry or fiction at all. Someone else who is absolutely, a completely devoted to fiction and novels, but isn't particularly moved by music. You know, if I'm curious whether you surveying the whole field of arts and culture, do you think that it's worth trying to develop one's taste in a field that doesn't seem to come naturally, or is it more worthwhile to just stick to the kind of medium or tradition that particularly moves you without you having to work too much at it?
You know, I would say try to put in some work.
Yeah.
But if you need to give it up, that's fine. And there's even neurological reasons. Like, I think about 1% of the human race has a condition called amusia. They just don't enjoy music.
Yeah.
And trying harder is not going to get them there. I've read Milton Friedman had this. Should Milton Friedman be trying to appreciate Haydn's Paris symphonies? Probably not. So I think it's fine. And it means when people look at the things they love, they'll have these very skewed perspectives that might be out of balance, but the rest of us can still learn from that. So I'm fine with that kind of specialization of consumption. And we all have it at some margins. Like, I don't really go see ballet or modern dance. I'll admit that's my fault. Mix of time, I go see plenty of other things. I saw Wilco in concert last night. That was very good.
Yeah.
But I don't go to ballet and modern dance. And, you know, you like to think, oh, I know all these fields. But relative to the whole, no one knows really that much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. So I wanted to ask or speak broadly about the question of about modernism, about newness, etc. Thinking back, you know, in very simple terms, it seems like there's been an imperative, you know, as Pound said, make it new, you know, certainly in the era of so-called modernism, a widely felt need to kind of be present, be contemporaneous, be contemporary. I think there's a whole book that I read about what is contemporary art? Why do we call it contemporary? And, you know, a simple idea might be, well, it's something to do with the state of technology and rapid economic development that, you know, let's say several centuries ago, when technology and the economy were not changing as rapidly, people were more comfortable with tradition. But now with so many things changing so fast, there's more a sense of urgency to be up to date. I wonder if you just had any general thoughts on that question of, is it important for art in general or judgments about art to reflect the present in some way?
Well, I'm not sure the general claim is correct. So if you look at so-called popular music,
right,
people today listen to music a few decades old much more than they used to.
Yes.
So when I was a teenager in the 1970s, it was unthinkable that someone would advocate for the music of the 1940s.
Right, right.
Even most of the 50s, you might like Chuck Berry or someone like that, James Brown, but most of it was just obviously passé. And now for people who are young to love the Beatles or Led Zeppelin, it's common. It might even be the norm. So we're less contemporary oriented in a lot of fields. The whole revival of interest in Shakespeare, Jane Austen, you know, very new novelists, can they really get attention?
Yeah.
Depends who they are, the genre. But again, I think they're in a worse position than they would have been in the 1960s.
Yeah.
So I guess I see the generalization, if anything, is running in the other direction.
Yeah.
I don't object to it either way. I think you just have to sort through and iterate. And maybe at some particular moment, it's not ideal, but it's never ideal. And I think we're in this bridge period where a lot of the new creativity hasn't quite come yet. So it feels like a drought, but I'm not very pessimistic about it either.
Yeah. I remember, I mean, as a young, as a Gen X person, listening to the Beatles and thinking, oh, this is great. It is sort of my parents' generation of music, but they are pretty good. And I love the Beatles for my whole life, but I never, ever, ever would have predicted that in the 2020s, seemingly every generation of young people seems to love the Beatles equally as much and or almost as much. And they're still at the top of the charts from time to time. But well, a little bit more specifically about art. So there's this quotation, which if one studies modern art, it becomes very familiar. It was written by Baudelaire about a now forgotten painter named Constantin Guy. But then at some point, people realized that if it was applied to Manet and other modern painters, it would somehow try to explain what they were doing. And Baudelaire said in The Painter of Modern Life was his title, saying that the painter should, quote, extract from fashion whatever element it may contain of poetry within history to distill the eternal from the transitory. And then a bit later, he said, by modernity, I mean the ephemeral, the fugitive, the contingent, the half of art whose other half is the eternal and immutable. So this sort of formulation of half and half, transitory and immutable, seemed to capture the imagination of at least some critics. Does this make sense at all to you as a kind of formula for modern art?
Yeah, maybe the economist in me is coming out too strongly here, but it just sounds like a bunch of words.
Okay.
You know, we just bought a print by William Kentridge, who's still a very active artist.
Yeah.
It's an amazing print. I don't even know if I should call it modern art. Is it eternal? Is it transitory?
Okay. Yeah.
I'd go back to the proper nouns are underrated.
Right, right.
And I think discourse about very specific things often gets us further. I think now's a great time for a lot of creativity.
Yeah.
And we can enjoy it. And I don't mind people agonizing over the abstract categories. But I do better talking to GPT Pro about the arts than I do talking to such people.
Okay.
So our best art critic today is GPT Pro.
Okay. Yeah. I can see that. I might predict this may be a similar thing, but in The Education of Henry Adams, he became very thoughtful and melancholy, let's say, while encountering new electrical technology. And he wrote a long piece about the Virgin as the inspiration for these truly amazing works of Gothic, etc., in the European past, and the dynamo, which he clearly saw as the wave of the future, so to speak, and which was awe-inspiring in its power. But he was worried about an alleged lack of soul or something like that in the dynamo. So I don't know if what you would respond to someone like Henry Adams, who sees culture as defined by these two opposing poles.
He never listened to Jimi Hendrix, right? That's electricity, driven by electricity. But that said, Jimmy, there's two YouTube videos where he plays acoustic guitar, and that's amazing as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I do think we're in this bridge period where AI is not quite good enough yet to create amazing art, and it will be soon. And there's a sense of we're all waiting for that. But it will come. It will be an aid to the human, but it will be a quite incredible flowering of a new technology.
Speaking of, this is a bit of a side thing, but there was a comment recently that somehow it seems to be the use of language in particular that gives rise to all kinds of worries about consciousness and so forth. In other words, when looking at AI in image generation or in protein folding or something like that, people don't seem to worry so much about whether AI is conscious, but it seems to be something about language that triggers this sense of concern in humans. Do you have any views on that?
Well, it's our biological programming fooling us.
Yeah.
So because of evolution, we're trained to think that things that talk to us are alive and sentient, and they used to be, but now we have things that talk to us and they're not. And we're just making a mistake. It is, in fact, a glorified cash register, not a complaint, but there's no alive, sentient being in there. And even some very smart people have just fallen for this hook, line, and sinker. I'm amazed.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of AI and art, so like at this point in time, summer 2026, when I see an AI, mostly when I see an AI generated image, to me, the highest value at this point is often some sort of clever concept, like if someone wants to make a kind of joke or cartoon and say, give me 10 monkeys in academic year pointing at the blackboard, and they just get it right away. And I say, oh, okay, that's funny. But assuming that it will get very, 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 very good soon, at generating great pictures, let's say. You know, I had the thought that there's trying to sort of disentangle one's reaction to these things. Circling back a bit, you know, there's the longstanding question of forgery. Like a truly great forger, a truly great kind of counterfeit maker of paintings can make a very good painting, and then you enjoy it, and then you discover that it's not a real Rembrandt or whatever, and you feel cheated ethically, you feel wronged by being misled. But retrospectively, does that sort of taints your original enjoyment of the picture, or at least does for most people. And then that reminded me, I mean, I think you're my friend Robin Goldstein, who does research into kind of blind tastings of wine and things like that.
It's like, yeah, well, he's great.
If you think this is a $10,000 bottle of wine, you might like it better. So I suppose my rambling question here is, if it's a great picture that you think is done by a human, and then you learn that it's done by AI and you like it less, and that's perhaps a little bit like learning that a painting was forged and not really a great Baroque painter, say, is that, I don't know, should one sort of train oneself to separate the aesthetic and ethical judgments and be able to just enjoy it if it's a great picture? Or is it somehow inseparable from the kind of, you know, overall scenario of having been done by a particular person, and it's just not possible to recover that enjoyment once you learn you've been so-called cheated, let's say?
There's a number of different questions in there. I would respond to a few of them. I think one should adopt a portfolio approach, that you should always want to love some art done by AIs. We don't have good enough art yet for that, but I think we will soon.
Yeah.
And you should always want to love some art just done by humans, and then want to love some art that is collaborative. Just like you should always be interested in like some Brazilian music, some Cuban music, some gamelan music.
Yeah.
It's a pretty common intuition, and I think we can transplant it to this new realm. Now, that said, I think a lot of these famous forged works, they're not actually that good. And I think a lot of people, they don't have an eye as good as they think they do. And the mistake they're making is they fall in love with too many Rembrandts.
Right.
And the notion that a lot of these great artists, much of it wasn't that good to begin with.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to buy into because they feel they're supposed to like it. But if they're willing to make that mental adjustment, they'll be fooled less by forgeries. I do think things like a Malevich forgery can be indistinguishable from a good Malevich original work.
Yeah.
But a lot of the forgeries, or, you know, like the Haydn forgeries, they were never great Haydn works to begin with. Like most of the Haydn symphonies, they're not that wonderful. And yeah, you can forge one, but you can't forge one of the, you know, top tier London symphonies. So I think we need to be more discriminating. And that's what the forgeries are showing. Not that the forgers can do it so well.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think a related sort of scenario that I think about are these cases where a painting is lost, and then eventually through expert connoisseurship, it's reattributed to a master. So these, you know, the really famous ones in the last year, Salvatore Mundi, eventually determined to be Leonardo, right here, not far away at the Kimball Museum, a small painting of St. Anthony that was eventually redetermined to be a Michelangelo. And I think to myself, you know, if you see it in a thrift store listed for £100 or whatever it was, and you would walk past, but now you won't walk past it because, you know, it costs tens of millions of dollars. Or the famous experiment, I think Joshua Bell, great violinist, played on a subway platform and people ignored him. Is it, you know, I don't know how to put this. I sort of think to myself, well, if your view is so dependent on knowledge of how much someone paid for it, maybe you should kind of relax a little bit and just wander around and see if you might enjoy something in a thrift shop. Or our final case would be that, as far as I understand it, it's almost impossible to see the Mona Lisa because everyone wants to see the Mona Lisa, so you have a couple of seconds. But, you know, 100 feet away, there's a gallery of amazing paintings that's almost empty because they don't know.
Right.
So I don't know.
The Poussins. So yeah, but the two works you mentioned, to me, they're not amazing. Salvatore Mundi, I don't really like it. I'm not even sure how much is by Leonardo. I read some of the debate.
Yeah.
So yeah, we need to be more skeptical and cynical. You know, this happens with Shakespeare. And just to say, not every Shakespeare play is wonderful, even though I think at least 2/3 of them are. Is King John so great, or Henry VIII? Even Taming of the Shrew, I don't love. And maybe some parts are by other people or derived. But like, just trust your own judgment more. You might be wrong, but you'll be fooled less on these other occasions if you're just willing to say, a lot of these Rembrandts are just a bit so-so to begin with.
Yeah. I remember So I think watching the two noble kinsmen on streaming and thinking, if this were all we had, would we think so much? Often when I'm talking to people about, you know, I actually think it's worse with people who are educated. And
yes.
They talk about going to museums, and I don't know if you'd call it the super ego. There's a little voice in their head saying, I need to be able to show that I understand this and appreciate, or I'll be exposed as an uncultured rube. And it seems to sort of spoil their experience. I want to say, you just have to switch that off, just wander through and stop when something interests you, and don't worry too much about whether you have the correct interpretation or whether you're, you know, showing yourself to be uneducated. Just kind of notice your response and do that, because I think it interferes.
Popular music fans do much better on this. It's very easy to get Beatles lovers to debate what's the worst Beatles song, and they'll pan whatever their pick is. Like, what do you think is the worst Beatles song?
Oh, I mean, Wild Honey Pie. I don't know. I mean,
that's one of my favorites. I would say like Good Night, where Ringo's singing.
Okay.
I don't know, but you're just not that ashamed to have a pick.
Right. Very true. Yeah.
But no, I need to talk you into Wild Honey Pie. Just try re-listening for one thing. I wish it were longer, but it's also perfectly short.
Okay.
And I think very original. The vocal,
it all
fits together. The sound is very massaged, though it sounds natural. It's quite a produced song.
Okay. I'm open. That may have been just a hasty, you know, it just popped into my head. My second answer is that I think some of the really famous, like, in general, I'm definitely a defender of Paul McCartney against the kind of pro-Lennon conventional wisdom that Lennon was more edgy and Paul was too sort of sweet and treacly. But that said, there are a few Paul songs like Hello, Goodbye, let's say, where I think, oh, this is just a little, I don't know, it's too, but we can, you know, we can postpone.
We can argue, but that's one of Paul's best songs, and it's quite sad. Hello, Goodbye. Like
much
of his best work, or Hey Jude, there's something tragic in it. And a lot of John's edginess, like Tomorrow Never Knows, Strawberry Fields, the actual work was done by Paul. John had drafts of amazing songs that would have been like good, but not great had John done it on his own, a bit like the Off Tracks on the Mind Games album. And Paul and George Martin turned them into these masterpieces. So many top John songs are really half Paul, and people don't realize that. But very few Paul songs are half John.
Yeah.
What John added to the Paul songs was just being an audience. Like, Paul, you can't send me this bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
And that was very valuable, but different than Paul's contribution. But if you listen to the interplay, like the drums, the bass on Hello, Goodbye, the sadness in the vocal line, I think it's one of Paul's like top 20 songs.
Yeah.
And I agree he has others that are too schmaltzy.
Yeah.
Many. I mean, dozens.
Well, yeah, no, I'm open to hearing otherwise. I just wish that when people went to MoMA, say that they would have more of this attitude and just be willing to say, you know, reflect on their instincts and their, rather than worrying too much about whether they get it. But so I wanted to, there's a recent Ross Douthat column where he pointed to the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco. That's San Francisco, obviously. New York, say, or other Gilded Age cities are full of, I think, truly great public monuments from the Gilded Age barons who wanted to leave their cities something that the public could enjoy and be inspired by. And Ross Douthat's claim in that column is that the most recent era of tech wealth has done less for physical public spaces than that previous era did. And my thought, I found that plausible, and I thought, well, maybe it is the case that if you are more digitally oriented, you underrate or undervalue the actual city that you live in and the value of making a great building for people to enjoy. I wonder what you thought of that argument.
Well, I think Ross is right. My hope is some of it is demographic and age related, like Mark Zuckerberg is now buying art. Will he build a great art museum? I have no idea. But, you know, Northern Arkansas, the Walmart money led to a wonderful museum. It's not called tech wealth, but Walmart succeeded by being a kind of tech company.
Yeah.
The new county museum in LA, I haven't seen it yet, and I'm not even sure who funded it. I think there's quite a good chance it's wonderful. The new George Lucas Museum, we don't call that tech wealth, but you look at Star Wars for 1975, it was a kind of tech wealth in the movie making. Yeah. So I'm not entirely pessimistic. I'd say it's an open question.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of regression toward the mean. We had this amazing era centered in New York and a few other cities, Detroit, Cleveland, that are closely packed together. They're near where Ross lives. They're easy to visit. Maybe we'll never do that again. But I don't think we need to be that pessimistic.
Yeah.
I see a lot of green sprouts, green shoots.
Yeah. Yeah. Just as after I said that, I remembered that I guess there's the new George Lucas Museum of Narrative Art, brand new museum.
Yeah. I haven't been yet. I don't know how good it is. But again, I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
The new Memphis Museum, I think it opened this week. Again, have not been.
Yeah.
Key Bronley in Paris, one of the best museums in the world, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's pretty new, 10 or 15 years old. The museum in Doha, one of the top 20 museums in the world.
Yeah.
Again, pretty new, not US, but if this all becomes more global, the new museum in Bangalore, you can go on and on. Again, it's not as bad as it seems at first. Will China fill all those museums with good art? I don't know. But again, it's an open possibility. It could end up being quite wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, slightly related, the question of permanence, of posterity, of long duration, you know, stipulating that I'm grateful every day for digital tools. I can go and page through incredibly high resolution images of these medieval manuscripts, which I would never otherwise get to see in my life, that are held in the Bibliothèque Nationale or something like that, or even just on Wikimedia, high res images of all the paintings in like the Staatsgalerie in Stuttgart or anything like that. So it's a wonderful age, but I also worry, you know, I put in my email, if I'm looking at a web page from 2005, my expectation, which is usually correct, is that almost every link is dead and that lots of things that were made are sort of now gone. And I worry that if so many of the greatest artists today are making digital work, I mean, is it going to be around in 100 years? Is it going to be around in 500 years? Is a fraction of it? I just worry that, and this is probably overplaying it, that there's going to be these great things that future generations won't get to enjoy, which if they had bothered to make it in a tangible form, might have had a better chance of survival.
Well, I have that worry, but keep in mind it's not new. So most movies that humans have made have not survived, especially from the silent era.
Yeah,
even you know, Greed, which is a complete classic, we only have parts of that.
Yeah.
You know, the Vermeers, a lot of them almost didn't make it through.
Yeah.
Parts of Bach didn't make it through, and a lot more might have not made it through.
Yeah.
But we're about to enter a funny era. Like, once token costs fall a bit and AI improves, imagine a world where, like, every day there's 1,000 excellent new paintings.
Yeah.
That will be a world you will live to see.
Yeah, yeah.
And what are you going to do with that? Spend all day combing through them? Tell your AI to find the one you like the best and it sends you one a day.
Yeah.
And they'll be digital at first, but you'll be able to convert them into actual physical objects as well with real dimensionality and hang them on your wall.
Yeah.
It'll be disorienting. We're not used to that. But in a funny way, if you think about the past stock of, say, music, how many people know all the Bach cantatas, the Monteverdi madrigals? So there's this effectively infinite stock out there already. But you hold it at bay because you treat it as old and, well, I'll get to it, and you don't really quite. And we're going to recreate a new version of that dilemma with 1,000 excellent new paintings every day.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll develop blocking and filter mechanisms so it will feel pretty normal and we'll just see our way through it. And if a lot of those 1,000 fall apart, well, 10 years later, there'll be 10,000 wonderful new paintings every day. That's how we'll cope with it. I know it's weird.
Yeah, not asking you to speak specifically in any way, but I know that you have been thinking about aesthetics recently, and you know you've reflected on some of these questions and thought about the state of aesthetics. I wonder if in the last year or so or recently, if you've had any particular insights about the state of aesthetics today that you might not have had a year or two ago.
Well, Patrick Collison and I set up a new grants program called New Aesthetics.
Okay.
And both Patrick and I share the view there are just too many things in contemporary life that people do them without trying to make them beautiful or even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And this is most obvious in architecture.
Yeah.
There's so many American, or for that matter, European cities you can go to. And there's some dividing line. You can debate what the year is. But any building put up after that line can be so, so ugly. And buildings before that line in time can be so beautiful.
Yeah.
And the modern world is much richer. And it shouldn't be impossible to meet a higher standard again. And some places do. I'm a big fan of Helsinki, parts of Copenhagen.
Yeah.
You can go on down the list. But it seems to me we're considerably underperforming relative to where it could be. And we wanted to raise awareness of this and did some number of grants. So that experience, I would say, overall made me more optimistic. A lot of people were very supportive. You always wonder when you start something, well, will you get trashed on Twitter? What are these people doing in this area? Everything's fine. But that was not the response at all. People are like, yes, this sounds very interesting. Of course, I'm not saying everyone is going to agree with all the choices, but that's not the point. I thought it was a very positive response. And when I talk to so many people, I sense this new and renewed interest in beauty and the aesthetic.
Yeah.
And I found that very heartening.
Yeah.
Now that we're still putting up ugly buildings, but I'm more optimistic than I was a year ago.
Yeah. You know, there are any number of, you know, very, very large, very old institutions that fund the arts. If you look at the bio of a kind of successful artist, there's often a list of their awards, fellowships, etc. But it seemed to me on a quick look that something was captured or something was supported by these new aesthetics grants that might not have typically been caught by whatever you name the kind of existing arts funding. And I assume that would be one reason why it was done in the first place. But I wonder if you would want to characterize anything that might be different about the work that you saw and the work you decided to support versus what might go through, let's say, the normal channels or the legacy channels of arts institutions.
Well, there were people who applied who seemed to be doing very well already.
Yeah.
And whatever you might think of their work, they were not a focus for who it is we would support.
Yeah.
I've run a number of other grants programs, mostly not about the arts.
Yeah.
And that's been my general rule. I have people from very, very prestigious, well-funded institutions applying to me for support.
Yeah.
Nothing against their work, say in the sciences or economics. And I don't feel it's what I was put here on earth to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but like fresh talent, I think there's plenty of it in the arts and in most areas.
Yeah.
So again, I've become more optimistic in the last year or two, including in the arts.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's great. Well, fine. I don't know enough to have a very good list of names at hand, but I'll just ask if you might name a short or otherwise a list of things that you think are underrated in the arts and aesthetics.
You mean that people maybe have heard of?
Underrated or overrated? Those are my questions. Underrated or overrated in the arts and aesthetics?
Well, I mentioned before, we just bought this print by William Kentridge.
Yeah.
I think he might be the best truly active artist in the world right now.
Yeah.
Noting that Kiefer and Richter still produce works.
Yeah.
But they feel very factory or studio driven to me.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they're really operating at their proper level. And they're both old. Kentridge is still at or close to peak.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, lives in Johannesburg, and he's certainly well known, but I think quite underrated relative to his quality level and the historical importance of it and his interest in beauty. David Hockney just passed away. It's crazy to call him underrated, but I think he is.
Yeah.
He did wonderful work in 1954,
mm-hmm.
that self-portrait that hangs in Bradford. Now imagine doing quality work in multiple media for 70 years plus, teaching yourself how to make prints in a way that you don't just sketch something and hand it off to someone else, but you become a master of printmaking and its techniques, working with iPads, being a first-rate art critic, art historian, just general force of nature for 70 years.
Yeah.
He's like the Paul McCartney of British art or vice versa.
Yeah.
And I don't think that level of achievement really has been sufficiently appreciated. So he would be another example, kind of a counterintuitive. It's like saying LeBron James is underrated, but
right. Maybe
he is too. Those are two names that come to mind. But, you know, in music, I think Robert Ashley is a great underrated American creator. You could call them operas. Mm-hmm. I meet a lot of very musically literate people who've never heard of Ashley or his work. It's like New York City avant-garde scene, maybe peaking in the 1970s. Morton Feldman, maybe the most important American composer he's not listened to that much, certainly has his partisans and is in some ways a cult figure, but I think should be like better known than Charles Ives, and he isn't. And I like Ives a great deal.
Yeah.
So those are some pick names out of the hat choices.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. How about overrated?
Well, I think there's much less of that. When I said before, this notion like the critical market is pretty efficient. But I think if you look at any art in the last 5 to 10 years, relative to price, most of it is overrated.
Yeah.
In any time period.
Yeah.
And it will vanish.
Yeah.
So if you went to a Whitney Biennial, and I just went to the recent one, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, and I mostly liked it. I'm not down on it. I thought they did a reasonably good job.
Yeah.
But I think at least 80% of it will vanish, and ex post, you could call it overrated. I don't even mean that as a criticism.
Yeah.
Most of it's overrated. I think we're in somewhat of a weak period for contemporary popular music. There's a lot of very good songs, but it feels to me a bit stagnant in terms of new ideas, that something could come out today and you wouldn't know if it had come out today or 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Whereas in 1965 to 1966, even over the course of a year, maybe you could tell when something came out.
Yeah.
So there's something overrated in that.
Yeah. I remember when studying contemporary art, getting the advice to kind of go to the back when people still went to libraries, as I still do, but not everyone does, go to the racks of old art magazines from 30 or 40 years ago, pull down, look at the art magazines and see who the artists were on the cover and getting shows in the big galleries and see how many of them you recognize. And it's always, you know, just if you only know the contemporary of the contemporary to have a concrete sense of how quickly those things come and go. But anyhow, we've been speaking today with Tyler Cowan about aesthetics, new and otherwise. Thanks so much for having this conversation and being here.
A real pleasure. Thank you, Ben.
This is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and there's more at athenaeumreview.org.